It's not that long ago when people in North America or Europe felt very far removed from the effects of a drought in the Horn of Africa.
There are no local problems anymore. The challenge of climate change is a global challenge. And the typical mindset of let's have local solutions or I'll solve my own little part of the problem is running up to its limits.
And while Africa has had very little to do with what's causing the climate problem, it's feeling the brunt of the extreme weather patterns and left footing a bill they can't afford.
And this is a call for us to see the problem as global, identify the needs as global, identify where the resource needs are most urgent and where the resources are most able, and then work to create opportunity out of the challenge in a way that's timely.
My name is Michael Olabisi. I'm an assistant professor here at Michigan State University in the Department of Community Sustainability. So I work at the intersection of economic development and sustainability. And as you can imagine, those two increasingly intertwined over time.
Michael Olabisi is also the author of Paying Africa's Climate Bill, published in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. So in this piece that we're going to talk about today, you talk about novel solutions to the funding gap when it comes to climate. But it seems the not-so-novel approach has dominated the strategies of the past several decades. With not much to show for it. Are we in a rut, do you think?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good way to describe it, that we're in this rut where we have a habit of doing some things and we're faced with a new situation and we have not yet figured out how to reinvent the tools we have or come up with new tools for addressing a relatively different challenge. The novel solutions I highlight, you could say stem from two perspectives. On the one hand is the cold cash practical perspective, mm-hmm. which says, ask the experts, ask those who know best, how much it will cost to have a meaningful response to climate change, both at the local, regional, and global levels, and add those numbers up, and then look around to see who has the resources to match that need. And the way the numbers look is an order of $3 trillion over the course of a decade for Africa, more than $1 trillion a year on the global scale. Mm-hmm. That's needed to have like a meaningful, above bare minimum response to climate change. Mm-hmm. And the development banks, the international financial institutions that typically address international challenges, mm-hmm. Which is what climate change has been coded as at this point, do not have those resources. I mean, I'm sure they wish they do, and I'm aware that many of them are gearing up and working very hard to raise those resources. But at this point, they just do not have them. And I don't think the world can wait another decade or two decades for the World Bank or the IMF to reinvent themselves and raise the resources needed to address climate change. So I guess this is a slow build up to the fact that we should just ask who spends about $1 trillion plus a year that we can approach and say, look, here's a new way to spend your money. Hmm. And that's the private sector.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, why is it, do you think, that the private sector hasn't really been proactive or jumped in where there seems to be, you know, some opportunity there for them?
Yeah, you're correct that that question naturally falls out too. Like if the private sector does have the resources, why is it not seizing the opportunity? Mm-hmm. It's a host of answers, but some of the most prominent elements of it is that the incentives are not clearly lined up. And in some ways, there's also the question of policy uncertainty, combined with some other typical political economy challenges that make it hard for corporations to invest and commit. Mm-hmm. To just take a step back, the typical corporation needs two things. They need an opportunity to invest and create value, economic value, And they also need the certainty that when they invest, things won't shift around too much until they make their return. An easy example will be a country like China, the world's largest auto market today, and at this point also the largest market for electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. And I'm not standing here championing electric vehicles as the only solution, but it's a good example. More than a decade ago, the Chinese policymakers made a commitment and we will make a positive shift towards EVs. It was a very firm policy commitment. There was incentives thrown behind it. And all the people who were in the business of making and selling cars knew that this commitment would not waver and they could see the opportunity of, we have to find a way to make profit selling EVs in what was going to be the world's most populous country and largest EV market. And a decade later, the results speak for themselves. And we're looking at, I think this will be the first year where half of the cars sold in China will be EVs. Wow. The U.S. is still trailing behind. We're still talking 10%, 12%, maybe hopefully end of this year. So in a way, when policy incentives are set and firm for the firms to operate in and the firms understand that this is their way to make a profit, they commit to it, they invest, and we see results.
Hmm. Okay, so there's no escaping this the climate crisis. I mean, the impact is being felt in different ways in different parts of the world, and they all have funding challenges to address it. But would you say the stakes are higher in Africa, do you think?
Absolutely. And in many ways, this is the point of the article that I wrote. The stakes are higher for two simple reasons. On the one hand, you have the issue of exposure. By exposure, I mean, especially when you think of things like agriculture, when you are in a region of the world that's already hotter than average, and the trend looks to warmer in the climate, issues like heat stress affecting yield are a lot more significant for the typical African country than, say, Canada. Mm-hmm. And when you're in an area where about half the population is involved in agriculture, a large share is quite literally subsistence. Whether you eat depends on what your land produces, and you don't have things like irrigation as adaptation. The exposure to the risk of climate is very high. That exposure or vulnerability is then coupled with a second challenge of the lack of resilience. So it's not as if, the average African country is high income and can muster the resources to adapt or deal with the challenges that climate change will bring. In the article I mentioned, you have large coastal cities like Lagos and Dakar, maybe even Conakry to some extent. I mean, that's about 1 million people who, if we know the sea levels will rise on the order of like a meter or 3 feet in the course of the century, cities like Miami can afford to put funds out and build a seawall or install pumps, other things to mitigate the effects of rising waters. Charleston might struggle, South Carolina, but they still have the resources to do it. They can muster that. Lagos, a city of approaching 16 million people on that range, does not. So the absence of resilience, the absence of resources to adapt or deal with the change is a lot more pressing on the continent. And the combination of this to the high exposure to things like higher temperatures, more droughts, rising seas or rising waters is real, and the absence of tools to respond to the change or be resilient in the face of change compounds the challenge. And I think it's important that both locally and globally policymakers understand the dual nature of this challenge facing African countries.
And locally and globally, like you say, you're right, because whatever happens in Africa doesn't stay in Africa in terms of climate. It spills over borders in different ways. Africa is also home of the youngest and the fastest growing population in the world. So do you see the international community actually acknowledging how important it is that we help in whatever way we can Africa to deal with this climate crisis?
Thank you. And I love that you highlighted that. The next things I'm going to say both address your previous point about opportunity that the private sector can see, but also the need for policymakers to pay attention. If you looked at every region of the world broadly defined, so the North America, South America, Europe, Asia, and Australasia, just about every region in the world right now, the population is either fairly stable or declining. The region of the world where we still have notable population growth is Africa. So on the one hand, if you are a corporation that wants to survive more than 40 years and you're thinking, where will my market be? You need to start looking, you know, what options exist for creating a market, sustaining a market, investing in industries and a renewable energy economy in Africa so that, you know, that's where my income comes from. On the other hand, if you're a policymaker looking for where the challenges of the future will be, or how do we prevent millions of climate refugees out of a Lagos that is, you know, a quarter underwater in 40 years, we need to look to Africa as, you know, the site for both opportunity and challenge. And again, you phrased it very perfectly. This is not a question of choices we have. We do not have a choice that things will happen and many of them will be centered around the African continent. What we do have as a choice is how quickly we respond to make opportunity out of those challenges. I know for more than a decade, there was conversations about putting solar panels in the Sahara and Morocco and then shipping the energy to Spain. Political, you know, technical and other considerations have held that up, but it's not too difficult to think of other variations on that project or just, you know, work around that still make something like that very feasible. I mean, the Sahara is the world's largest desert. And it's an example of a place that gets, you know, way too much sun. I mean, more sun than people know what to do with. And that sunlight can not just be used to create things, you know, like power that's shipped across the ocean, but it can actually be used to make things locally at lower costs than then, you know, get transported to other regions where the cost of renewable energy is higher.
I found that interesting in your piece. You brought up this problem of being too country-specific when it comes to creating incentives to spur private investment. What do you mean by country-specific?
No, thank you again for asking this. So maybe I should try for two examples, and they're kind of contrasting examples. So if you were drilling for oil in the U.S. and you got depletion allowances, this is quite literally the government paying you to produce, you know, fossil fuels in the U.S., which is not necessarily a terrible thing, but, you know, we know that in the long run, the world needs to transition away from fossil fuels. And you don't get the same allowance for doing the exact same thing elsewhere, because the money is American money going to an American company operating on American soil, and so it stays local. To use a more relevant example, I live in Michigan. If I chose to put a solar panel on my roof right now, the federal government, maybe even the state government, my local, you know, utility will pay me some of that money back, as much as 30 to 32% of that money. So again, this is American tax money going to the American household, you know, doing something for the environment in their house in Michigan. But the reality of a global challenge is that, you know, that 30% of, you know, of the solar panel that I'm planning to put on my house in East Lansing here would yield to 30 to 40% more energy if it was put on a field in Ghana or Cote d'Ivoire. So the novel solution I'm calling for is policymakers need to start considering an accord, and we have some of the frameworks for this, things like the Paris Accord, where we ask ourselves, this year, the world will make, you know, another $100 billion or however many billion dollars of renewable energy investments, both public and private sector. Where can we get the most positive climate effect for the dollars that we're putting in? There's something, it may make sense from a Michigan perspective to support someone like, you know, Michael putting his solar panel on his roof, but from the global perspective, it doesn't make as much sense, because we are shortchanging ourselves to the tune of as much as 40% of the effect that we can get.
So it's about looking for those places where you get the most bang for your buck. And you just you mentioned Ghana and Burkina Faso and you all these places that offer tremendous potential in terms of private investment. But what about the risks of doing business in Africa? A lot of people working in the private sector avoid Africa, have avoided Africa because they're worried about instability, economic as well as political, especially in these countries that we're talking about with the greatest need for climate financing. How do you convince investors that the benefits outweigh the risks?
There's two answers to that question. The more obvious one is that they don't need any convincing. The proof is there. We have windmills that operate in Kenya right now that, despite the high cost of capital, are still profitable. You have several smaller level solar installations that have been working just fine in spite of the challenges. And from that perspective, you could just argue and say everywhere you go, there will be some kind of risk. It's the job of businesses to manage risk, and that's what businesses do. Mm-hmm. But a more honest response is actually that people like me, and I should make it clear, I grew up as an African before I came to the USA very, very, very long time ago and became an American. Mm-hmm. My experience as growing up made it clear to me that there is no such thing as a risky African space. Just as there is no bad city, every city has one bad neighborhood or two bad neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And you don't avoid the entire city for that reason. Mm-hmm. And you don't avoid Africa or price and everything that's African high because you don't know that within the same Africa, there's a Tanzania that has been basically politically stable since forever. Mm-hmm. Senegal that's never had a coup, that's in West Africa other than its peers. In Nigeria that's had more than 20 years of democracy, with its challenges and not without risk, to be clear. I guess the honest answer I'm trying to give you is that for anyone that looks carefully, there is opportunity that comes with limited risk. And then it's up to the private sector to choose the level of risk that you're comfortable with. If Ghana is the place that you're more comfortable with, then that's a level of risk you're willing to take, fine, enjoy. If you have advantages that let you, manage the risks that are maybe relatively high in, say, Mali or Burkina Faso, go for it. And my conviction is that even if you price the risks in, there's still untapped value that's left untouched or left on the table as things are in Africa right now.
Well, let's hope that the private sector does wake up to the fact that there are plenty of opportunities, climate-related opportunities in Africa that would move the agenda forward in terms of dealing with the climate crisis. Michael Olabisi is an assistant professor at Michigan State University. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bruce. I enjoyed talking with you.
Look for Michael Olabisi's article, Paying Africa's Climate Bill, in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, which used to be Twitter, @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.